Hello and welcome to the second of our bite-sized regulation podcasts. And this time round, what we're going to do is we're going to talk about probably the most famous of all payment regulations, PSD. Now, I'm sure if you're in different countries around the world, you might say, oh, that's not quite right. But on balance, I would say that PSD is probably the most famous because it's probably the most talked about. I'm super pleased to have with me again Monica Monaco, the CEO and founder of Trusted EU Affairs. And welcome, Monica.
Hello, Paul. Thank you. I'm very happy to be here again and to be able to do this podcast with you.
Thank you. And me too. So, look, we're really pleased to have got the first podcast out. Please do give us your feedback and give us any comments or any direction that you'd like us to look into. But let's get going. I really want to dig into the PSD, the Payment Services Directive, and its various updates. Now, as with nearly all regulation, obviously there's always a first, but nevertheless, with nearly all regulation, and PSD PSD2 is not the only one, but clearly it builds on previous works of art. Namely, PSD2 came from PSD, and we'll go through that in a second. But at the time we had PSD, we didn't have numbers, so it was just PSD. And of course, very soon we'll have PSD3. And for those who are avid listeners of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, you could say, in fact, it's the fourth in the trilogy. I guess that's a very niche joke, and not many people who understand payments will talk about Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. But nevertheless, effectively, PSD3 will be the fourth variant. Now, typically when we discuss regulation, everything is focused on the why, the what, and the when. And mostly the how is for the financial institutions and, of course, the industry groups supporting them to work out. And as with many things, but clearly with regulation, the why is really the most important step. Because if you can't understand the why, a lot of the working out, a lot of the rationale sometimes doesn't make sense. And quite frankly, in the middle of the heat of all the discussions and all the conversations, people often lose track of what the original aims were. And while times it's sometimes very hard to hear and very hard to accept, the regulators are really trying to improve our society. They're really trying to look at what they can do to help us all. So the why is really that they're trying to foster and increase competition to the existing actors, the banks. They want to create a more level playing field across all the financial institutions, and they want to create a more balanced set of customer rights with corresponding obligations for those actors. Now, does this cover the main tenets, Monica, of what the European Commission's aiming to do with PSD and in particular PSD2?
Oh, well, I would agree this covers the aims of the PSD2. I mean, the PSD2 comes with the idea of updating and complementing the European rules that were put in place by PSD1 in 2007 and also adapt them to the new ecosystem in payments. The main objectives of the PSD2, according to the Commission, are to contribute to a more integrated and efficient European payments market, also to improve the level playing field for payment service providers, including new players that get a license via the PSD2, and make also payments safer and more secure for customers, and of course, protect consumers. I would say these are the main aims of the PSD2 in the European Commission, let's say, plan.
Yeah. So I think, you know, so if we go back, you know, PSD was first released in 2007, and I'm sure there was lots of work done before then. But in 2007, and to be fair, and in my opinion, it seemed to be, in retrospect, more about setting of scope and definitions, defining a new legal framework for payments in Europe. And it felt as though there was a lot of heat and not a great deal of light. Now, obviously, it's, you know, quite a long time ago. That was quite a long time ago, Monica. But is that your view now, looking back at PSD?
Well, you know, well, yes, I would agree. I mean, PSD1 was about really providing a legal foundation for a European single market for payments. So it was the first time the Commission was regulating payments from one bank to the other, really, to establish some form of safer and more innovative payment services across the EU. So the idea was also to make cross-border payments easier, more efficient, and more secure. Actually, as secure as national payments were within a member state before PSD1. So, in my view, PSD1 has allowed more competition also in the payment market because it's been creating, with the payment institutions license, a competitor, new competitors to the incumbents, to the banks. So, it also offered economies of scale and helped a lot in building the single euro payments area in practice. Now, of course, if you look at this from a consumer perspective, PSD1 was also meaning transparency and more information for consumers, for example, about the execution time for transactions and also for the fees. Also, it has cut execution times. And also, with the PSD1, we had a stronger refund rights that were created. And also, more importantly, there was also this clarification of the liability of consumers and of payment institutions. Also, PSD1 is famous for the D+1 rule, which allows payments to be credited to the payer receiver's account within the next day. And this didn't exist before PSD1. So I would say PSD1 is the foundation for all the legal framework for payments in Europe.
And I think that's an important point as we start to go through the various levels, because while it brought in some major steps, actually it felt like it was the building, it was the stepping stone. But in 2009, it's my view that from the Commission's point of view, they believed that the payments market and the ecosystem had changed since PSD1, and the legal framework of PSD1 that had been created was not suitable anymore for the new ecosystem, and they started to work on amendments to PSD1. Now, the desire for uniform payments and their ambitions really felt like they weren't being met.
Well, the Commission proposed to review the PSD1 to modernize it, in fact, and also to take into account of new types of payment services, such as, for example, payment initiation services, which were good in bringing more competition in the payment market, but were not previously regulated. So the Commission decided to create a license for third-party payments provider under the PSD2 and brought these services in scope. Also, certain rules in the PSD1, like, for example, the exemptions for a number of payments-related activities, like the exemption for limited networks or the exemption for payments via mobile phone or other IT devices, had been transposed and applied by member states in very different ways. So there was legal uncertainty. And that's where the Commission decided also to review these definitions for them to become somehow more precise. So the Commission proposed to revise the PSD1 in July 2013. And the proposal, the PSD2 proposal, was part of this package of legislative measures on payment services, which was called the Payments Package, which included also a proposal for a regulation on interchange fees for card-based payment transactions, so the current interchange fee regulation, which entered into force in 2015. So indeed, I would say that PSD2 comes to the Commission as a way to adapt and to update and upgrade the PSD2, the PSD, in consequence of the changes that happened in the market between the PSD1 and the 2013.
So I think I see them as layers, and we get to 2015 and we come to PSD2, the current version. And again, in my opinion, it seems that the Commission was still not seeing the change that it was hoping for, and it felt like it was going to up the ante. They introduced many changes, but the two that really stand out for me, and you've mentioned one of them already, Monica, is the introduction of third parties, PISPs and ASPs. Now, this is pretty much a revolutionary step. That's obviously my view. But they brought these third parties in to the ecosystem, effectively allowing non-banks to initiate and aggregate payments. And I would argue probably the biggest change, and of course the second one, SCA, strong customer authentication, which, while had its issues, certainly touched everybody within the EU. Now, Monica, I know that you were very close to PSD2, but what are your views on its introduction and its impact?
Well, Paul, yeah, I would agree that the main changes are this. I mean, PSD2 has basically been widening the scope of PSD1, covering new services and players, as well as extending the scope of the existing services. So, of course, there was the creation of the third-party payments provider's license, as you're saying, which allows account information services and payment initiation services to be regulated. But PSD2 also updates the telecom exemption by limiting it mainly to micropayments for digital services, includes also in the PSD scope transactions with third countries when only one of the payment service providers is located within the EU, what we call one-leg transactions. It also improves cooperation and the information exchange between authorities as far as authorization and supervisions of payment institutions is concerned. Also, the EBA, the European Banking Authority, which was not present at all in PSD1 as it didn't exist at the time, is asked to develop a central register of authorized and registered payment institutions. Also, the PSD2 introduces, as you're saying, enhanced security measures that should be implemented by all payment service providers, including banks. And in particular, it requires payment service providers to apply strong customer authentication for electronic payments transaction as a general rule. Now, what does this mean? This means that payment service providers are obliged by the PSD2 to apply strong customer authentication when a payer initiates an electronic payment transaction. So what it is, strong customer authentication? This is an authentication process that validates the identity of the user of a payment service or of the payment transaction. And strong customer authentication is based on the use of two or more elements categorized as knowledge, possession, and inherence. And this can validate the user or the transaction. Now, these elements are independent, which means that the breach of one of these elements does not compromise the reliability of the others, and are designed in a way to protect the confidentiality of the authentication data. Now, for remote transactions, for example, online payments, the security requirements go even farther in PSD2 and require a dynamic link to the amount of the transaction and the account of the payee to protect even further the user by minimizing the risks in case of mistakes or fraud. Now, all this didn't exist in PSD1, so I find PSD3 much more complex and also much more correspondent to the ecosystem of payments that was indeed in place in 2013.
I think that's absolutely spot on, Monica. I think that's a fantastic summation. So now we've got PSD2, and we had bits of strong customer authentication late, as many people will know, but now, if we sort of get up to speed, if you will, if we look at it from a current day, we naturally would skip to PSD3. But before we get those glasses on and try to look too much into the future, I think there's one more step. And that step is really the retail payment strategy. And it's very rare that you get the opportunity to interview the commission officials. But I was lucky to be able to do that. And I was super excited to be able to interview Sia Pereira from the European Commission, who was one of the officials in charge of writing the paper. And that interview can be found on our website. Please do search Finestra and regulation, and you'll find the video there, direct from the commission, if you will. But, you know, Monica, this was a very powerful document. Would you like to just outline some of the key elements and perhaps the scope that RPS brought in?
Yes, absolutely, Paul. First of all, I agree with you, it's a very powerful document. It's 24 pages only, which is kind of rarity for European Commission documents length, as we discussed in our previous podcast. So it's only 24 pages, but it's very, very strategic as a paper and explains, in fact, which is the European Commission strategy on payments-related regulatory changes for the next 4 or 5 years. This was out in September 2020, and it covers a wide range of themes. So first of all, the retail payment strategy covers the matter of instant payments, which, according to the Commission, shall become the new normal in the payments ecosystem. So the retail payment strategy hints at the possibility that a legislative initiative may be necessary for instant payments, for this to become widely used, if the take-up of instant payments in the market doesn't grow autonomously. As instant payments are in principle irrevocable, the RPS also considers how consumer protection shall be enhanced, and suggests that the Commission could envisage specific rules on refunds for instant payments and on the level of fees that are levied on consumers for their access to instant payments. Also, the retail payment strategy explains that the Commission will explore ways to promote the use of electronic identity and solutions based on trust services in order to support the implementation of strong customer authentication. So some form of level 2 strong customer authentication to come, if you want. And also, the retail payment strategy mentions the review of the PSD2. So it's a strategic document, extremely helpful to understand what the Commission is doing currently and is going to do for the next couple of years.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, the retail payment strategy document is a really, really very, very coherent and forward-thinking document, but it's very practical as well. So my reading of the journey so far is that the Commission has stage by stage increased its position and its direction and has got a lot more confidence in trying to get what it sees as what it wants. And the RPS is that very important piece of work that, while very wide-ranging, is also very coherent. And it literally ranges from the digital euro to non-EU payments. So please do have a look at that video. It is very, very insightful, a piece of work, and it's much easier to listen to than to read the 24 pages, I can tell you. Anyway, the commissioners call for feedback. And so the feedback now is on PSD2, and that happened earlier in the year, in June, in fact. And this is effectively the commission asking the industry to give its feedback on what they see as the good, what they would like to be improved, and of course, what they would like to see in PSD3. Now, Monica and I have represented Finastra's feedback, and we have participated directly in the public consultation. And I look forward to further commission. I look forward to further engagement with the commission on our feedback, and of course, getting their feedback too. So consolidating all of that feedback, and there will be many, many people giving their points of view, is a key step in the way that the Commission understands what the industry is trying to articulate, and it will consume some of it, and presumably some of it won't. But clearly at this stage, there is a lot of lobbying and positioning going on. However, I think it's fair to say that PSD3 is not that far away, probably early next year. And if I was to give my simpler view on it, I would say there's probably three things that I would pull out. And there's so many pieces here that it's a little unfair. But the key things that I would see is there really needs to be a fairer balance of responsibility between the banks and the third parties. And if you will, at the moment, the banks are acting like the adults and perhaps the third parties are behaving a little like the children, and there needs to be a balance between that. And I think I would expect something along that line to happen. I would also expect us to see a stronger point of view that says, hey guys, the data does belong to the users. And while people might want to use it, the data belongs to the users. And of course, there is also the introduction, in whatever form it eventually takes, will be the digital euro. And there will be a whole bunch more of information, a lot more detail that's coming. But I from my simplistic view, I think they're the things that I see at the top line. I would expect to see the regulation that Monica related to before about both sending and receiving of immediate payments and its fee methodology to encourage immediate payments. I expect that to be coming up fairly soon and later this year. And, you know, that's what we hope to discuss a little bit more about in the next podcast. And I expect that to be out before PSD3. Monica, I know it's a big subject, but are there other things that you want to add in at this stage about what you see coming along the line?
Well, I just wanted to confirm what I said on the retail payment strategy, that it was foreseeing a regulation on instant payments, and it appears the regulation on instant payments should be out, should be published by the end of this year. There was an initial date for publication that was the 21st of September. This seems to have moved now to the 7th of December. So we expect the regulation on instant payments to be published by the Commission before the end of 2022, likely in December.
So I agree, and I look forward to that, because I think that's probably one of the pivotal steps of us being able to move into the digital world. But as we've discussed, there are so many phases of the regulatory file, PSD3 moving into its final stages before it actually gets released. The point is, if you go through this history going back to 2007 and before, there are many stages and many building blocks that have enabled us to get us where we are right now, and hopefully where we will be with PSD3. And hopefully we've outlined the history and the stages of how we got to get to where we are. And I think it's a key point that I'd like to keep on reiterating is, while it appears sometimes that these things just pop out and there was very little notice, with a little bit of look and a little bit of insight going backwards, you can see all the stages and all the building blocks and how they've come to pass, so that, in fact, they don't just pop out. And that's one of the aims of this podcast, trying to put things into a bite-sized nature. So, you know, PSD3 has been in the baking since, 2007? And, hopefully this is keeping you up to speed with where we are. But before we get into the wrap-up, are there any final comments, Monica, that you'd like to make?
No, I think I would agree with all you said. And indeed, I mean, understanding the process allows also to foresee what is next. So the more there is an understanding of what happens between PSD1 and PSD2 and why there is PSD2, the more allows also us to foresee what is going to be in PSD3. We should be indeed an adaptation of some sort of PSD2 to the current payment ecosystem.
Yeah, I think that's right. Looking at the stages helps you look to where this is going to go, and in fact, the retail payment strategy document also adds a lot of color to that. But so great. So let's pause on PSD for now. Our next podcast will be on immediate payments and the upcoming regulation. If you're enjoying the podcast, please do subscribe to the newsletter. It will contain further insights and news, and we will add a link below. Please, as I say, please do give us your feedback. And I certainly look forward to the next bite-sized podcast on immediate payments. And for now, Monica, as ever, thank you for being such a rock star.
Oh, Paul, thank you so much. It's my pleasure to share the role of rockstar with you in this podcast.
Brilliant. Thank you. Thanks, guys.